Thank you very much. I start by responding to the previous session where it was suggested that our achievements, new achievements in technology, may eventually have some kind of doomsday effect of us, that we are creating something which will kill us. I am not in this camp. I believe that technology through the history had liberating effects. And in fact, the more we understand, the more free we will be from all kind of influences of that kind of. It won't be possible to manipulate if we really understand how this whole complex system works. And one of the ultimate complex system is right here. It is inside us. It is the most important personal computer we have. I just started by actually showing the real picture. Usually people, when they talk about the brain, they cut the brain from the spinal cord. In fact, Mother Nature didn't solve it this way. The brain and the spinal cord are embedded in the same kind of package. And the whole thing lives in the sea, which reflects the fact that we came from the sea. Because nervous system, to operate properly, requires external environment which has the concentration of sodium, potassium, calcium, and some other. It's essentially a chemical computer. And it requires this external environment. So actually, our brain swims in the sea, which is artificially created inside us. And so we still live in the sea, essentially. And it's a very smart design from the mechanical viewpoint because it cushions the brain. So when we jump, the brain, which is this mass of neurons, very kind of soft and not strong, because it swims in the sea, so it just protected against it. Also, there is chemical barriers. So when you drink, for example, it passes several chemical barriers before what you drink comes to this area, protected area, which is just in the blue here. Okay, so you see how smart Mother Nature is. It not only designed this wonderful computer from the elements which extremely difficult to design, because you will see that those neurons are really kind of not very fast and not very efficient from the electronic engineering viewpoint. Elements. Nevertheless, this slow system, which operates in the 100 millisecond range, it outperforms our best computers. How does it do that? Because it has billions of neurons which operate simultaneously. So much about brain hardware. Later, if I have time, I will go a little deeper and show you what is actually inside the brain. That brain is not what you read. Important to understand that if you get knowledge about the brain from the literature about neural networks and artificial intelligence, you're learning about different brain, not the one which is in your head. Okay. So I'm more concerned in this talk with the functional cognitive possibilities of the brain. So now when you saw, I gave you just this idea what this system really is, the hardware. And now I will talk about what it does. And the most impressive thing, that it has this remarkable unmatched ability, you can probably read it from the screen, to learn. Learning affects everything. It's not just like, say, learning, machine learning in computer when it is just designed to improve, optimize some relatively narrow performance. Learning is actually forming the brain. It is a major Speaking in engineering terms, it's a major software development process. Okay. So I'm concerned with two, because I don't want to overstretch, so I will be concerned with two questions. First question, how can a programmable computing system achieve universality of type zero? I will explain shortly. That's the highest level of universality for Neumann computers and Turing machines. Using basic computational resources, which you saw, which you can reasonably postulate in this thing, which I showed you, in this biological thing. And second, how this, once we figure out how this architecture may work, how it actually creates almost all its software in the course of learning. Let me go down to, now I move to really high level abstraction. Let's see the big picture. On the right, there is this computing system which simulates the work of the human brain, and we assume that it is possible, and I'm a strong believer that it is possible. It's just that the system. Okay, and then on the left, there is the sensory motor devices and the world, which means every one of us has this world. And you, to me, you are this external world. To you, I'm this external world. But we all have these computers, which I showed you, sitting in our brain. So one computer is now talking to many other computers. So, and my goal is really to communicate my understanding of how it really operates. So why did I... Let's divide it into two parts, brain on one side, and these devices and the world on the other side. Then we really cut the brain not just between our sensory devices and the world. We cut it inside. So in this case, there are only signals. There are no red, yellow, green, there are no sounds. There is the same uniform signals coming from the system WD to the right and from the system B to this system. Okay. So my first counterintuitive claim is that let's start with the brain B. Well, I call it brain, but I'm actually talking about computing system. And this system DB can be thought of as a human-like robot. But I divided this robot inside. So computing system on one side and robot's devices and the world is just another system. It's a convenient way to divide. Okay, so let's call this B0, brain zero. That's how my website is called. And B0 is the some kind of formal representation of B at the moment zero, at the beginning of learning. I claim that this representation can starts with something which can fit on a single floppy disk. It's a kind of shocking, probably, statement, but I have plenty of evidence. In fact, so system which is almost empty, almost no software, and I claim that you can say in no special language is needed, you can describe it and say C, will define. But then what happens? Say 20 years passed, and now the system is, well, much more unfortunately passed for this system, but for some of systems sitting in this room, well, 20 years maybe just passed. So anyway, it doesn't matter. These systems now, I claim, no matter what formal representation, no matter what language, it will be in terabytes, just because it should include the individual experience of the system. Okay, so the question is very clear. If you really believe in what I said, you get something which is on the floppy disk, and this system has this ability to suck knowledge from the outside, and it becomes enormously complex system. And how can it do that? Okay, I first start with this levels of, because before talking about learning, usually when people talk about learning, they don't mention what level of universality you're talking about, because there is learning and learning. For example, if system learns to classify something, it's what would be called combinatorial type of machine. So I need to make sure that you know that these levels of computational power exist. Probably many of you already know that. I actually introduced type 4, this so-called Chomsky classification, type 3, type 2, type 1, and type 0. And there are formal languages which very clearly shows that, say, system of type 3 cannot generate language of type 2, and so on. So there are hierarchy of behaviors, complexity, and hierarchy of computing power. So Chomsky starts with level 3. I introduce additional level, lower than that, combinatorial machines, which has much sense for the learning systems. Okay, so what is that? What are these levels? Why they are so important? Let's go to combinatorial machines. Combinatorial machine is essentially a function. It just maps, it's a programmable, in this case I'm talking about universal combinatorial machines, machines which can be programmed in principle to simulate any function. So what resources do you need to build this machine? It's easy to show. You need programmable memory, read-only, but programmable. And you need some fixed interpretation procedure which will read and interpret what is in this memory. In this case, I used programmable memory which has two rows. And to explain you concept of interpretation procedure, okay, let's interpret this table, which is A, B, C, B, B, whatever. Let's interpret this, that input is the input alphabet, inputs, all available inputs. And output alphabet of this specific example is 0, 1. Suppose interpretation procedure does the following. It goes from the left and finds the first match, right? Then if I send A and reads the symbol from the second row and retrieves it, what kind of machine will be? Okay, if say I send A, it finds the first A and it will retrieve 0, right? So if I send B, it will retrieve 1. If I send C, it will retrieve 0. Suppose I use different interpretation procedure. I go from the right. Then on C, it will retrieve 1. On A, it will retrieve 1. And on B, it will retrieve 0. What it shows you that though machine is completely determined by what is in this memory, how this memory is interpreted depends on the interpretation procedure. Let's use a more interesting interpretation procedure. Suppose it finds all entries of A, right? And then it finds this set, A0, A1, and then, say, at random, retrieves with the probability proportional to how many times this symbol is inserted. In this case, this interpretation procedure would interpret this table as probabilistic machine, which means on A it will respond with equal probability with 0 and 1. On B it will also respond with 0 and 1. So for a while, let us assume that we have this fixed interpretation procedure which does exactly what I explained to you. It just kind of finds all the entries and then retrieves with probability. Probability will be very important in the concept which I describe, because I claim that brain is essentially a probabilistic system. Okay. So this is combinatorial machine. Or four, in my interpretation, kind of my slightly extended Chomsky classification, it's type four. It's convenient. What is the example? If you know electronics, programmable logic array is a typical example of that. You have programmable AND array, programmable OR array, and the system kind of, so you can program it to implement any combinatorial machine. But not probabilistic combinatorial machine. Okay, let's go to the next level. How do you get to the level of state machines? The idea is very simple. You split, and that's what electronic engineers use when they actually implement these devices. You split this table into two parts. One part describes inputs, A, B, C. Then the second and the third row will describe state and the next state. And the fourth row will describe what you retrieve. It's easy to show that any combinatorial machine can be implemented as state machine with the feedback. What is important to understand that you cannot simulate state machine with combinatorial machine, because in this case you have, depending on the state, you have two different combinatorial machines. So by switching state, you switch the system into different combinatorial machine system. Okay? So now I jump to the highest level. How do you implement any universal computer? As Turing showed at some point, what is needed is just to add to that random access memory or tape. Okay? So, well, I will skip that. I have this PowerPoint which we will be able to read. So anyway, there is a deep actually reason why you cannot implement something of higher level with the lower level, because you always get combinatorial explosion. You try to implement, say, state machine, assuming, say, limiting the length of the input sequences and mapping that as combinatorial machine, and you get explosion because the size of PROM grows as x to the power of n. And if you want to implement this universal computer using state machine, though it is state machine, it again, the size of tape produces so many different states that it explodes combinatorially. So really, it's not the reason that it's kind of theoretically you cannot implement. The problem comes much earlier in the form of this combinatorial explosion. Okay, I hope. Okay, let's now kind of, this was a little boring maybe, but let's now apply that to the brain. Let's make this observation. A person with a sufficiently large external memory aid can perform in principle any computational procedure. That's how Alan Turing invented his machine. He assumed that no system can calculate more than a person with a big memory. And then he decided to reduce this machine to the simplest possible form without losing this ability to compute what person computes. Okay. I skip other observations, and I go directly to kind of my vision of Turing machine. You can think of Turing machine as a robot which calculates on the tape. And to make it more kind of human-like, I introduced I, which reads single symbol from the tape. I introduced speech, which robot talks to itself. It tells what next state he wants. And I introduce this, what Turing machine requires, write symbol and move. Okay? So this robot is a Turing machine, but it really gives you kind of robot-like interpretation of Turing machine. Let's go one step further and ask the question, what is the brain? Suppose I'm serious about that. Which means, okay, Turing took a person, reduced the person to the level of robot, and invented it, made this most prominent discovery. He invented universal computer. Let's go in the opposite direction. Start with the robot and gradually build it back into a human. So the Turing machine is a good place to start because it's already universal, which means we don't have all this problem of not having enough computing power, which you will see a big problem with the brain. We take universality for granted because in computers we have more, in all our computers, we have more than enough resources to get universality. But it doesn't buy you principal advantages, it buys you only efficiency. You don't get combinatorial explosion, say, if you describe this laptop in terms of Turing machine, which is essential. So how do I implement it as a, what kind of brain? And here I show the simple brain. Well, these are neurons, big circles, and small circles are synapses. So it's very similar to this programmable logic array, except that this layer, intermediate layer N2, these neurons would compete, so they would select a single line, a single associations, let's call it, randomly. And they will select associations with the highest level of excitation. So I don't have time to go into the theory of that, but there is exact theory of that which is absolutely explicit, so whatever I say can be proven either theoretically or computer simulation. In fact, I have a program which simulates it. Okay, so this is sufficient to get the robot, universal learning robot, in a sense, with this very simple concept of learning. So how do I teach this robot? Suppose I have control of the robot motor centers. I plug these electrodes, and now I can make this robot do whatever I want from teacher, right? So I can force it to compute. What I want, that after I finished several examples, this robot would learn to do any examples from this algorithm. Is it possible? Yes, in this very simple way it is possible. And okay, so, but I want to get rid of the neural network, so I actually go to what you need are three procedures, decoding, then choice, and encoding. And these three procedures, if you can implement them efficiently, you can build the robot which I described, which would be able, also you need some kind of procedure of learning, which means how data would be stored in the robot's memory. And then this robot simply tape record the data, which means it simply records these signals in the memory, which means it just records all the input signals in this upper part of this network and the output signals in the lower part of the network, in the synapses, and that is sufficient to actually learn anything. Okay, so let's go and ask more difficult question. Suppose I want this robot to do mental computations. That here I come to the problem of working memory and mental imagery. Suppose I want to build a robot which would do the following. Like, once I showed it several computations on tape, it would be able to mentally simulate this external system. Do you remember I was talking about this right part of that? How the world, how tape is seen through the robot devices. So how can you make this happen? Because I claim that the brain doesn't have random access memory. There is no room in these networks for random access memory, and this is a very kind of important claim, which means somehow you need to reach universality without having a memory buffer. Imagine how many of the traditional algorithms would survive this limitation. You probably would have to drop all traditional artificial intelligence algorithms if you are not allowed to move data into RAM buffer. So how can brains still do that? Okay, so let's now, so this is my problem now. So I want this system. Let's assume that there are two systems in the brain. One system which does motor control, the one which moves robots, which speaks, which moves robots, hand to write. Another, which simulates this external system, the external world, in this case, tape, as it is seen through these devices. Can I arrange this system in the same way as the previous system? Well, yes, I can, but I need... So this is kind of my final robot. I want this robot to do the following. If I force it to compute, it then will learn not only to compute on tape, but it will also learn to compute on... compute mentally. And this is a kind of implementation of this robot. So there are two systems, and they are represented as tables. All the machinery is kind of skipped, but I have description of this algorithm in one of my papers, and also you will. I have references in the PowerPoint, which will be available. Okay, so let us, and I can force this robot to do anything by actually typing symbols here. So because I don't have time, I'll just show you some examples of this training. In this case, the robot was trained to do so-called parenthesis checker algorithm. It needs to determine whether for any left parenthesis, there is a matching right parenthesis. There is a simple Turing machine algorithm which does that. So I actually forced the robot to do three examples. I showed it by forcing. And that is what is in robot's memory after that. Okay. Now, what I will do, robot now looks at the tape. You see there is this little kind of switch memory tape in the upper part. So robot looks at the tape. So it reads this data. It reads this data. Then it turns and it opens the eyes. So it now, it closes the eyes. So now it will see everything from the memory only. It still goes and computes, which means without actually memory buffer, it computes and it learns to compute, and it will do perfectly well with this algorithm. So what happened? The robot learned, I showed the robot how to do few computations, and now it is capable of doing any computations from this class. How is it done, actually? Let me close this. So I just showed it, because it's a big topic, so probably don't have enough. Okay, the only thing you need, if you don't have memory buffer, you need to introduce this analog memory. And it is plentiful. It is available in the form of so-called neural modulation. So suppose you have this neural network. Do you remember there was three-layer neural network? So the only thing I need to add to that is this modulation, which means when the robot or whatever, when this network receives the signal, the level of excitation, of residual excitation in this location is higher. So it creates this bias. Okay, so let me, this description, I will not go through this, you can understand it. But let me explain how it actually achieved. It is achieved through the effect of recency. Imagine that you bias this table, which means you have, in the upper part, you have, for example, this association. 3 is associated with A, 3 is associated with B, 1 is associated with B. But when you send, say, 3, you will not get A. You will get B, because B has the higher level of this modulation. So what I'm saying, that you can really get this universal architecture without memory buffer, just by playing with the levels of an analog memory, which is plentiful. And this changes a lot of things. Do I make any sense? Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, good. Good, because it's real effect. It's real effect. You can replace system with random access buffer by system which has only programmable read-only memory and has this analog memory which biases this programmable memory. And this is a kind of good way for the brain to do this thing. The reason for that I will explain later. So first of all, I showed you that just without memory buffer, I got universal architecture, universal Turing architecture, which means it's a different architecture. It's a different type of computer, universal programmable computer, which can be programmed by simply forcing it to do something, which means you force it at random, if the robot did the right behavior somehow, and this behavior is reinforced, then that's it. Robot got the right software, which means I'm saying that with this approach, software and behavior is almost the same thing. You don't need to program the system to do things. You need just to stimulate it to do the right behavior. And then if this behavior is stored in some way, like I showed you, there are many other continuation of that. But in some simple way, this behavior, if it is stored in memory, that's it, system is programmed. And now you can at least understand in general, outline, how we can get so complex. Because suppose we start with some relatively simple software in the form of these associations, which forces us to do more or less right things. And then, of course, we make mistakes. And there is another system, which I'm not talking about here, system of reinforcement in the brain. Okay, so once you form this state of long-term memory, you're already programmed to do that, which means just by accumulating your experience, you're getting software which allows you to do more complex behavior. You do more complex behavior, you get more complex software in your memory, and you become more complex system, and there is no end to this evolutionary software development loop. And this is not possible with memory buffer, because with memory buffer, you would have to learn how to use memory buffer, and there is no way you learn to. In this case, it's done automatically, because memory buffer is always kind of activated in a way so it reflects that the latest event is more excited. And this produces the same effect as if you rewritten the symbol in that. Does it make sense, right? Okay. Anyway, but it has much, much bigger implication than that. So first of all, we got universal architecture. We don't use memory buffer, which is very important. We got effect of working memory, which means this robot really sees this tape. And this explains, by the way, how I can play chess mentally. Because if I play chess, oh boy, what is that? My clock is. Oh, okay, okay. Okay, so if I'm playing chess, I somehow can move pieces on the board, right? And when I moved it, when I return to this position mentally, I see the new piece which I placed, it, which is exactly effect of random access memory. Okay, but why it is good to have this memory in this stupid way, kind of, instead of just simply writing and rewriting? I told you one reason. First of all, you cannot learn to use RAM. There is no way. Like, say, if processor in this computer would memorize all its actions, it would not create software which would run this computer again. You need much more structured software In the case you do it this way, you just showed how to do something and you created software, which does that. But much more than that, okay, let's concentrate on this thing. And this was neurophysiologist Zopf Jr. in 1961, who said, I don't believe in all this artificial intelligence and all these things, because humans can do combinatorial number. And it is a very interesting article, Attitude and Context. You may find it. He said, humans differ from computers because we can do combinatorial number of different activities. And you guys, you're simulating only some small number of these activities, which means you're simulating enormously small part of the human behavior. And it doesn't matter that you simulate 100 or 1,000 or millions, because we are talking about more activities, possible activities, than there are atoms in the universe, much more. Okay, so how this activation of the programmable memory would explain this phenomenon? Okay, very simple. Suppose I have this table which has all associations needed to create two input, one output Boolean functions, right? In this case, I spend 8 locations of memory, right? And there are 16 Boolean functions. So I can select some of these elements of this table and I get Boolean function, right? And I'm showing you, if you select something which is shown on the top, you get XOR. If you select something in the second row, like 0, 1, and 2, and 7, you get AND. And so on. And in fact, you can even get kind of noisy end, which will be probabilistic Boolean function. Okay, in this case, no big deal, because I spent 8 locations of memory, which is 2m. M is the number of inputs, and in this case, there are only 2 outputs, right? So, but I got 2 to the power of 4 Boolean functions. Suppose, however, I have m inputs, 10 inputs, right, in this table. I will need to spend 2 multiplied by 2 in the power of 10, which means I will spend 2048 locations of memory only. How many Boolean functions now I can get? I will get this n. 2 to the power of 1,024, which is an enormous number. This tells you something, how the brain achieves this, not just universality, but how it achieves this configurability, reconfigurability. If you have software of the size only 2, like in this case 8 location, by correctly reactivating this software, you get functionality for 2 to the power of that number of locations, which means the only thing we need to explain how actually this is happening. And I claim it's a complex thing, and you really need to think hard about that. Really, inputs and your own behavior will activate your memory in such a way that just the appropriate part of your knowledge will participate. And because you can reactivate, change your, and this is what you can call mental set. So depending on, it's not just depending on what you know, but depending how you activate what you know, you become different system. And in the previous lecture, we saw that effect of mental set. People have mental set that, okay, that technology is produced doomsday scenario, right? Okay, but some people may have a different mental set. Some other people may have even some another set. And in fact, for you to understand what mental set is, I'll give you this example. I'll ask you this question. What, you probably know American history, what American presidents are not buried in American soil? Can you quickly answer this question? Bush is not buried. You see, what happened? What happened, because I said what presidents are not buried, not is not important. It doesn't produce much activation. But buried produce activation in your memory of the knowledge which is associated with death. So you're searching your memory for the dead presidents, and that's why there's delay. And you know perfectly well that there are alive presidents which are not buried in America. So, but you don't consider this possibility because your memory is activated. And in fact, you can, by activating your memory in many different ways, you can produce different mental set and different attitudes to the same information. And this has fundamental implications, for example, for pattern recognition. Because suppose I made this classification. I use backpropagation. I don't know how many of you know some other optimization algorithm. By the way, all those neural networks will be of type 4, so which is not a big deal. But anyway, suppose I produced optimal classification of faces or whatever. But then context changes. Yeah, suppose I learned to separate books from disk drives, right? I built system which does in whatever way perfect classification. But then I change context. I ask a question, take this. In this take this context, it's no longer important that this is book or this is disk drive. What is important is the size of that. What I'm saying that asking different questions about what you perceive changes your attitude and changes the required actions to that. And if you calculate how many of this possible attitude you can create, you get again this combinatorial explosion, which means if you build optimal classifiers, you cannot build optimal classifier for all possible contexts. You can only activate whatever limited knowledge you have so it matches this context. That's extremely important. Because, for example, if you have C++ program, you cannot take a marker and just strike this, strike this, strike this, strike this, the system breaks, right? But with the low-level software, like these associations, you can do that. You strike this, 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 and it's still perfectly valid and stable performance. This idea, in fact, can be developed very far. You can get statistical filtering, and I'm not really even touching this, scratching the surface of this iceberg. But we are coming to a completely new approach to that. That, first of all, we create this stupid software just without really programming in C, writing compilers, because it's not available in the brain. We are creating associations, and those associations are perfectly, as I showed you, perfectly universal programming language, which means you can program system to do anything. But more than that, those associations can be reconfigured on the fly in combinatorial number of ways, which means by creating relatively short software, you can reuse this software in enormous number of ways by simply reactivating it, which is really the topic of that. Okay, so I call these systems e-machines. The reason for E, because E stands for excitation or residual excitation. There was a neurophysiologist back in at the beginning of the century who was actually saying in intuitive terms what now I'm saying in this explicit terms, in formal terms, that this is something which is happening in the brain, this reactivation. So E stands for excitation. It also can stand, well, if somebody really, when I die, of course. It can stand for my name because Eli Ashberg and excitation has exactly the same number of letters. And Actually, Eliashberg alphabetically precedes excitation, if you check that. So it's okay. So anyway, this machine I started, this was a real hacking project because I worked, I did enormous, I'm a system engineer, consulting, I do a lot of projects for money. I did 3 projects for government, United States government, for money. But I could never get a penny for this project because, so this is a real hacking project which done completely as a private investigation. And I'm now beginning to really, because technology came, that you can really implement this stupid algorithm. These algorithms are enormously memory hungry. That's why, for example, even 10 years ago, it would be stupid to go this way. But now it is not. And I'm saying that actually, that's my hunch, that we will see in certain time, we will see the system because they will certainly outperform this von Neumann architecture for pattern recognition, for all the surveillance things which you're so afraid. But I'm more concerned with the other implication that really if you understand how our brain works and how we can be brainwashed by putting this, and how we can be mentally reactivated in this stupid way. And if we understand all that, it would be much more difficult to brainwash and to reactivate us, to create a mental set, so we will be much freer. So I think it's very, very important to understand how our brain works, not make all these kind of religious illusions or whatever, but really understand that we are systems, and it doesn't diminish us, because this system is probabilistic, which means it has free will. It can come anything. I think these robots will share some world with us. Okay, I'm almost finished, but I just want to show you that, yeah, you will see it on my website or it will be distributed as PowerPoint so you can go deeply into that. So I would say learning is evolutionary development. Then I'm actually comparing, how can it be that simple system? Do we have examples that simple system can produce enormously complex behavior? Sure. For example, I compare it with this Maxwell equations. Maxwell equations are enormously simple, but they produce enormously complex behavior just because they interact with more complex external systems. So that's what I'm saying. And there is a good analogy, in fact, at this general level between this approach, which starts with simple structure, which has only basic constraints, and then by interacting with enormously complex external constraints, it becomes complex. So it is doable. Then, okay, I'll talk about symbolic, non-symbolic, that you really cannot separate symbolic and symbolic. So, and then I go to neural implementation, and I actually show you the cerebellar network. It's something real in our brain. It's, the network is only 3 layer, the cerebellar network. And the network in the cortex is only 6 layers. So if you take this seriously, how this simple system can do what I'm doing now, for example? Or even what you're doing now, you're listening and pretending that you're understanding. But so this is, and this is done by this simple system. Let's take this seriously, which means it really, this mother nature is so smart that it found this super efficient integration of these simple things, which work that way. And I like that this way because nature always does these tricks. And this Maxwell equation is only 4 simple laws and you get all the variety of electromagnetic. So this one, then I'll show you how you actually can implement the architecture which I showed you in a way very similar to the cerebellar. And in case you have very large network. But then I actually go, this is output memory, this is input memory. So, but then I actually go to more interesting point at the hardware level. I'm saying that, in fact, everything is not really in the neuron itself, but much more goes to molecular level. And then I come with this, okay. So cells, in fact, evolution spent more time developing cell than developing brain. It took billions of years to develop cells. But then it just did like that. Brain was something like 50 million years old after cells were created. So it's simple. It's another indication that it's not so complex. Okay, that's neuron. All cells are organized on the same level, but neuron has this special proteins sitting in the membrane. So they're different by shape and by type of protein. And here I come with this idea that actually this protein molecule is this probabilistic machine. And you can develop this very well, and I have an article on that. And then you can get, I'm not going into that, then you can get implementation of this memory, which I, this dynamical memory, this E-states. You can view them as these conformations, relative occupation numbers of conformation in these machines. So it really goes deep. All of a sudden, just starting with this high level, you go to a very low level and everything fits well. Okay, and then you actually get that this protein molecules, and just by throwing these molecules into membrane, you get computer. You can prove that you get mixed signal computer just from that. So in fact, in a single neuron, you can have that type of functionality. But again, I'm just jumping. And then, okay, then, okay. That's a simulation of the patch clump experiments. Well, it probably means nothing to you at this point. That simulation is Hodgkin-Huxley experiments, how a neuron produces pulses. This machinery works. And then it produces, shows what is actually, when we, you read neural network literature, you read about synapse as a weight, right? And there is nothing further from the truth. This is borrowed from Kandel, who got Nobel Prize for studying aplasia. And that is what is in a single synaptic terminal, all that complexity. So, okay, so I finished. So my final desire that young and talented people like you would really, who can hack anything, would really start hacking this system. It's really a good hacking project. Any questions? Any questions? Okay, probably. Yeah. Probably I didn't give you enough information to ask specific questions. So my goal was just to kind of give you some initiation on that, so you may look deeper in.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. I have a question.
Yes.
I have just one question. Right. Thank you for a very interesting speech. I think for the last 50 years, we've been told that artificial intelligence is about 5 years away. So I'd like to have your opinion on the subject. Like, do you believe that artificial intelligence, like a machine capable of passing a Turing test, for example, is feasible at all in principle? I mean, are you aware of any fundamental obstacles? And do you still believe it's 5 years away?
Well, you see, first of all, I'm not a big fan of artificial intelligence per se. I think it's a kind of playing with words. What is intelligence, in fact? But I do believe that machines capable of simulating the brain are not far away. Yeah. If this is artificial, I wouldn't call it artificial. Artificial intelligence was a kind of more like commercial ploy to me, just claiming something which other people don't claim as good, just some good smart programming, but not so much better than any other programming. So that's my attitude to that.
If you do believe that we will be able to simulate the brain, do you also believe that at some stage we will get into processing power singularity, which would mean that by being able to simulate minds, we could accelerate the science development in that way that the time needed for example, doubling processing power will always get cut. In that way that at some stage, the processing power rises exponentially, making that if we say 1 year ahead from that point, that there will be no 1 year ahead, because processing power will rise that quick that a singularity like a black hole, an extreme dense form, will come and
you never can tell how people will use technology, but I do believe that certain processes, mental processes, which we would like to accelerate, we may not even want to accelerate it because we want to keep this kind of our privilege to enjoy this mental process.
I think many also want to use this for military purposes.
And it for sure will be used. That's probably, unfortunately, will be the first place where if we really make these robots, which kind of what's called universal learning, autonomous robots, so probably military, of course, will use it. But it probably will take some time before robots will be smarter than people. So I wouldn't worry about that at this point. So, but I'm more interested in actually how we can benefit from understanding how the brain works, how we can benefit in improving our own brains, becoming better users, like a kind of learning how to learn and learning what to learn. I think that would be kind of, to me, a more interesting thing.
To my understanding, the question of initiative is crucial for the question of intelligence. And as I see it, this neural network modeling only isolates this point and makes it obvious that it's a crucial question, where does the initiative to learn something, or more specifically something new, where does it come from?
That's a perfect question. And I actually showed you two systems which are needed for universality. This is sensory motor system, which was driving this robot's sensory motor devices. I showed you another system, that's my hypothesis, that there is another system which is motor sensory. It gets motor signals in the input and produces sensory, which simulates what we see and what we simulates how we see external world. But there is certainly the third system, which is, say, sensory, emotional, which learns to associations between input sensory events and what is present on our in this moment on our centers of emotions. You know that in the brain there are centers of emotions. They were discovered by Megun and Olds. That actually, if you take a monkey, and there was an article. So anyway, if you form this third system, which forms this motivational software, and you interact this system with this two, especially with motor system, then you get this architecture with motivation. So that's my answer to it.
So there's no secret about initiative in your eye.
Well, initiative is just complex implications of motivation.
Okay, I'm sorry I have to interrupt, but we're running out of time. Thank you again very much for an inspiring talk. I'm sure
thank you.
If you have further questions, I'm sure you'll stick around.
Yeah, I will stick around.